Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. Well, we've had yet another development in the Labour leadership contest, which is that, surprisingly, shockingly, Momentum have backed Rebecca Long-Bailey in a ballot of their members to become leader and Angela Rayner to become deputy leader. James, this obviously isn't a surprise because they were the only options on the ballot paper, but is this the boost to Rebecca Long-Bailey's campaign that she needs, given it's been quite quiet up to this point?
I think Rebecca Long-Bailey got a bit of a boost from that Labour list poll because what was going on since the first poll of a Labour membership was a kind of sense that Keir Starmer was so far in front that, you know, it was all turning into a foregone conclusion. I think that Labour list, I don't know whether you should technically call it a poll or a survey, but it is essentially reminding people that Rebecca Long-Bailey still has a good chance of winning. I think this Momentum endorsement is valuable to her, but I think one thing that will be a concern is the turnout in this ballot doesn't appear kind of off the charts. She hasn't, you know, had a Rebecca Long-Bailey moment yet, you know, of kind of, and I don't think you haven't quite seen the enthusiasm that Corbyn generated in his leadership bids for her. I mean, Angela Rayner getting the deputy leadership just adds to the sense that she is gonna, you know, it is just becoming very, very, very hard to see how she doesn't get that. I think it's an interesting question, though, which is, you know, how does this race develop? So we had Lisa Nandy do the Andrew Neil interview last night, and I think she did herself no harm in that interview, and I think she
got rave reviews from some quarters.
Yeah, I think she's now, you know, set the bar at a fairly reasonably high level for Keir Starmer and Rebecca Long-Bailey, and I wonder whether there is, she's certainly the candidate who has most performed on the upside in this contest so far, but her challenge is, you know, coming with very low name recognition into this contest compared to the other candidates. You know, I think there is a little bit of David Cameron 2005 about her campaign, but it's worth remembering that Cameron would not have won in 2005 if he hadn't had that moment at party conference, you know, where lots of Tory activists were obviously there. You had national TV. You know, that was his breakout moment. It's hard to see what opportunity, even though this contest runs all the way until April, it's hard to see what equivalent opportunity there is for Lisa Nandy in this contest.
Katie, where are we with nominations and affiliated organisations backing the various candidates?
So the Momentum backing is clearly good news for Rebecca Long-Bailey, but it doesn't affect her in the sense that it means that she is more likely to progress to the membership in terms of counting as an affiliate. What it does do, if you speak to the various leadership campaigns, is potentially give Rebecca Long-Bailey an edge in terms of data, in terms of access, in terms of targeting, because you have the Momentum base. And when it comes to getting those nominations from unions, from other affiliates and from CLPs, so far it's been interesting because I don't think all the listeners on this podcast, and I would also include myself in this, you know, follow trade unions with a microscopic knowledge. So when you hear a trade union is backing a candidate, so for example, we heard this week that the mine workers union was backing Lisa Nandy. Now, on the surface, some thought that perhaps meant that she was getting Corbynite support. But in 2015, this union backed Yvette Cooper, so it wasn't telling of that. Where I think there might be a warning sign for Rebecca Long-Bailey, however, is that the TSA today has said that they are going to ballot their members on whether they should back Keir Starmer or Rebecca Long-Bailey. Now, she could still win this, but I think there are some who thought the TSA would just naturally go for Rebecca Long-Bailey. And it's being read as a sign that if some of the natural supportive unions towards that candidate are not 100% sure, is that a sign of things to come? Now, even if Rebecca Long-Bailey doesn't get this union support, I think there's a sense that she should still be over the line, because the big union support everyone expects her to get is Unite. That is Len McCluskey's union, and it's seen as being Corbynite. And I think if she didn't get that, that would be a big shock. However, there is a chance, I think it's still unlikely, that she won't, because we've been hearing this week that Len McCluskey has met with Rebecca Long-Bailey and Lisa Nandy. His first meeting with Rebecca Long-Bailey didn't go particularly well. Apparently since then it has improved, but he has he did have very successful meeting with Lisa Nandy. So again, you get the sense that Long Bailey should get through this quite comfortably, but I think there are a few signs that reflect what we've been hearing actually since her campaign, which is ultimately that she hasn't had the surest start, and there are doubts about whether she is the best candidate to continue Corbynism. To me, it doesn't seem as though the biggest problem lots have of her is the fact that she is on a Corbynite platform. It's whether or not she is capable of delivering that message. And we will start to see, I think, in the coming weeks when we get these nominations in, if there is enough of a nagging issue to grow and become a real problem for her.
Now, obviously, this leadership contest is taking place because the Tories won a stonking majority. And while Labour's busy trying to work out how to deal with that, the Conservatives are trying to work out what to do with their much easier parliamentary life, James. And one of those things is something that Robert Buckland today described as constitutional plumbing, which sounds very exciting. Tell us what that is.
So this is this issue about judicial review and the role of the Supreme Court. And this is an issue that the Tory manifesto talked about having a review in, looking at it. And ever since the election, there's been looking at a lot of kind of commentary about what that means. So some people are, you know, according to some people, this is a kind of threat to the entire rule of law, etc., etc., etc. This is an attempt to kind of, you know, take revenge on the Supreme Court over the prorogation judgment and all that. The alternative way of looking at it is that I think the justice system has become more political cases have been taken since 97. And then the subsequent, the various reforms of the Blair era. And the courts have ended up entering into political debate more than they say they would like. But I think there is a danger that when you start entering into political debate, that begins to cause tensions. And I think Number 10 would like to kind of rebalance the scale so that essentially a government action would only be kind of right if it was kind of clearly out of bounds, that the government would basically essentially have a greater margin of appreciation for its decision making. But this is obviously going to be a very delicate matter because, you know, while the government might have a big majority in the House of Commons, this is the kind of issue that the House of Lords, you know, feels that it is designed to get involved in the debate on.
And is it really a given, Katie, that all Conservative MPs will feel sympathetic to this?
Well, it depends. Clearly, the devil is in the details. It depends on the specifics. I think what has been interesting is every time this topic is raised, people get on very high alert, and there's lots of, you know, people going out saying this is a threat to the future of democracy. I remember, I think it was before Christmas, in one briefing, some thought there had been a suggestion that we could be moving to politically appointed judges. Now, that was quickly rode back on, but it was interesting the number, I think, of Conservative MPs who, before they had real clarity, even if this was, you know, a miscommunication or Number 10 policy movement, went out publicly and said they were fully against this. So I think there are clearly limits, and I think there is something lots of figures feel very strongly about, whether they are legally trained, of which there are several in the Conservative Party. But again, I don't think get the sense yet that perhaps this is as drastic as some of the reports have suggested. And also it's partly because I don't think that Number 10 have fully made up their mind about what they are going to do, A, with this majority, but two, of all the reforms they're planning. I mean, even if you look, for example, at the Whitehall shake-up now before Christmas, and the reason this is being written about was because this is what was being suggested, but, you know, drastic Whitehall shake-up, we're going to close the departments, move them into others. Now I think there's been this realisation that this would take up too much bandwidth, so they're scaling them down. Similar, as James says in his column this week, talking about the reshuffle, not as drastic. So I think there are definitely things, and the judiciary is one of those, hence why it was clear in the manifesto where they wanted to be reform. But as those ideas are talked out, I think there is a sense that you have to prioritise the things you are going to do, so it might not be as big scale.
So could the plan to change the A&E waiting targets also go that way, James?
So this four-hour target, you know, it is consistently not being met right now. And, you know, you might say that it sounds like cheating to kind of get rid of it. You know, you fail to hit a target and then you decide to get rid of it.
Yeah,
it doesn't bit, doesn't it?
There is also an awkward optics question for the government, because the government says, you know, its priority is the NHS and we're going to get rid of its target. There is a different argument, which is that some clinicians do not think that this is a particularly sensible target to have, and that there are other things you should care about more. I think this is one of those things which is, you know, if the government do decide to get rid of it, it will definitely be used as a stick to beat them with. I think the political calculation you would be taking is that the few months of heat you would get for it now would mean that these stats would no longer essentially exist by the time of the next election. But I still think it would, you know, it is a difficult move for a government that comes in and says its big priority is the NHS, it's putting into law this record funding for it, and by the way, we're scrapping the target. That's and I thought it was interesting, some people thought that Boris Johnson might kind of move towards scrapping the target at PMQs this week when Jeremy Corbyn went on the health service. Boris Johnson certainly didn't appear to be trying to soften us up for that kind of change.
So on the subject of bad statistics, Katie, we've had the knife crime stats today.
Yes, and it's not good reading for the government. Knife offences hit 10-year high, with 60 recorded every day in the past year. Now, I think anyone who's been following the news knows that knife crime is clearly a problem. Violent crime has been on the rise. Yet somehow during the election, the Conservatives led by Boris Johnson managed to quite neatly distance themselves from the rise in violent crime. And that was partly by pledging to, I suppose, having Priti Patel's Home Secretary, who talks very tough rhetoric on it, and two, I think the one area where I do think the Conservatives have moved to the right, lots of people comparing Boris Johnson to Tony Blair, but where they have moved to the right is on crime, so longer sentences, more prison places. That policy area, I don't think you can say is moving to a more liberal spectrum there. So bad stats, but at the same time, I think what the government have managed to do is create this rhetoric around their crime policy, which means they're not getting as negative publicity as they might otherwise. There's also the fact that in London, at least, you have the blame game between Sadiq Khan, the London mayor, who then blames the Tories, and the Tories blame the mayor. So I think that's a capital-specific issue. Clearly, though, the government's record is going to catch up with it. So I think that if you have bad stats, you know, in a year's time and it gets worse, I think at that point it's much harder for Boris Johnson to suggest it's, you know, nothing to do with me, Gov.
So, James, you've written about this in your column this week.
Yeah, I think if you look at the election and the Boris Johnson decision to hire those 20,000 extra police officers, one of the things that really worried the Tories is that they were in danger of losing their reputation as the party of law and order. But, you know, you saw in the 2017 election how Labour managed to make police cuts work in their favour. The Tories kind of neutralised the issue in 2019 with this offer of hiring 20,000 police. But I think you're going to see a big, you know, focus on crime from this government for the simple reason that they basically think if they can't win on crime, then they are in a very difficult position. And also, you know, if you are in terms of sending out, you know, a message about this, you know, I often think this government is, I thought it was very interesting that when Boris Johnson was in Northern Ireland this week, hailing the return of Stormont, he made a play on Tony Blair's line about a hand of history on his shoulder and said, "I feel the hand of the future on my shoulder." And I think something that we can sometimes forget, at the top, this is a relatively old dynasty. You know, Boris Johnson, Eddie Lister, you know, Dominic Cummings, these are all people who cut their political teeth when Tony Blair was in his pomp. And, you know, what was one of Tony Blair's great successes was tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. And I think you're going to see from this government a real desire to not let Labour anywhere near that crime space. I've got a feeling that if the Tories can keep that there, and, you know, because crime is almost a kind of values issue at the same time, or kind of culture issue at the same time. And so if they can hold that space, they feel they make it much, much harder for Labour to come back and to show voters that they are, that they have, you know, returned to the common ground of British politics.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Katie, and thanks for listening. And we have another special event coming up which looks absolutely fantastic. Its title is "It's Time to Offer Amnesty to Britain's Illegal Immigrants," and it's got Kate Andrews, who's just joined The Spectator as our economics correspondent, Fraser Nelson, our editor, David Goodhart, head of immigration at Policy Exchange, and more guests who are going to be arguing about this hot topic. And to book, you just need to go to spectator.co.uk/amnestypodcast.